Henry Jenkins, February 5th, 1974.
Says, do you want to vote Republican in the Republican primary or Democratic primary? And if you elect to vote in the Republican primary, that means you give up your right to vote on virtually every local office. You might be voting for no more than a congressman in an unimportant election, because it's just the primary and the congressman's going to win it anyway. And they have extremely low votes in those things. Seems like the last time, out of 1 million votes cast, only 25,000 were cast in the Republican primary. So someone throws out this possibility: what if a black decides to run as a Republican against the incumbent Republican congressman? Now, the blacks don't give a damn about those other county offices. They give a damn, but by gosh, they could mobilize one hell of a vote in that circumstance. They could easily offset 25,000 votes in a district without any problem at all and dislodge a congressman from his seat. That would be most interesting, and then they'd be the Republican nominee running against the Democrat in November.
I already know what the book is, basically. I mean, you've seen the outline. And the standard opening question is, what has been the major change since 1948? The standard opening response is the change in race situation.
Yeah.
But Howard, why don't you just tell me a little bit, how does Alabama politics operate right now, and what has led up to it? And I don't care if you want to start at 48 and go forward, or start now and go backward. Usually it's better to start at the beginning and go forward, but sometimes it's easier to do the other and set the stage.
Yeah.
What is the state of development of the Republican Party? Why don't we start with
that? Well, generally speaking, you know, you can get what happened in Alabama, and V.O. Key gives you an absolutely flawless jumping off point.
Right.
He has it down as pat as anybody does in his chapter on Alabama in 48. Well, since then, there's been the struggle between Dixiecrat and loyalists and what have you. And generally speaking, the loyalists have maintained dominance. They've done it, I'd say, mostly by their superior mastery of the political process than they have through winning the, you know, the hearts of the people and that sort of thing. They're just a hell of a lot smarter than the Dixiecrats are. There was, for example, in 58, when we had one of these titanic battles, this always centered on the control of the Democratic State Executive Committee, which I maintain is an unimportant thing. The party politics and structure is relatively unimportant, and that applies today as it did then, but they still had these titanic battles over it. It's important to the extent that they do control or can control the presidential election to a large extent. But in any case, there were always these very close battles with, generally speaking, South Alabama. This is a thread that runs back throughout Alabama's political history. Conservative South Alabama voting Dixiecrat, and the somewhat liberal North Alabama voting Loyalist. And even in 58, when one of those years, when the state's riders won control of the Democratic Committee, the governor that year, Patterson, who was a loyalist, largely through the ineptitude of the state's riders, and also through some very shrewd political pressure within the committee, was able to turn the result around and elected a loyalist chairman and kept the party loyalist. And of course, throughout in the presidential election, it's always been, you know, back and forth between Dixiecrats or unpledged electors and what have you. And as illustrated, the closest of all, and I think this is the only time this has ever happened in history of perhaps any state, where the divisions were so close on Dixiecrats and Loyalists that in the 1960 election, we actually elected 6 electors pledged to Byrd and 5 elected to John Kennedy.
Were they on the ballot that way?
They were on the, not as that way. No, they were, the 11 candidates were on the ballot. It's extremely complicated, but electors in Alabama, Democratic electors, are selected by the people to go on the ballot. They're even selected by the people in voting before the nomination is made. And so they simply run as pledged or unpledged electors. And it was so close that year that the Democrats nominated in May a mixed slate of pledged and unpledged electors, which went on to the ballot in November. So the upshot of this meant that everyone in the state, if a million people voted in the state, they voted for 6 people who were against Kennedy and 5 people who were for him. You had just a completely anomalous situation there. Absurd, really. And that's the way they voted. Then came Wallace, and it looked as if the Republicans were gaining ground pretty substantially, just like they were throughout the whole...
Let me go back on Wallace just a little bit. With Wallace, my image of Wallace and life reading is that Wallace basically ran as a moderate out of some populist tradition mm-hmm. the first time for governor, mm-hmm. as a judge, mm-hmm. and he got beat. Is the story... Do you know whether or not the story is true about his alleged saying, you know, I won't be outsegged again, or whatever he said?
He denies ever having said that. Marshall Frady maintains that he has talked to someone who actually heard the statement made. I know where it's alleged to have been said. I think whether it was said or not is beside the point, because that was his frame of mind. It represented his frame of mind, whether he said it or not. And but in any case, he wasn't outsegged after that. So whether he said it, and I doubt if he used the term outsegged. I've heard the term "I'll never be out niggered again," and that sounds much more like Wallace. I think it's inconsequential whether he said it. But when he came along, in any case, Wallace had the effect of obliterating the old Dixiecrat loyalist split. He just didn't fit into either one at all, and he just completely obliterated it. His support cut completely across the board of Dixiecrats and Loyalists and what have you, and the split no longer exists, really. Although there's a tendency to think that the Dixiecrat element supports Wallace, I'm not at all sure this is true. At the same time, the thing that he did was by this phenomenal political control that he had over the state, managed to totally arrest the development of the Republican Party. It didn't proceed nearly as far as it did, for instance, in Georgia and in even in Mississippi. It didn't proceed that far, I don't think, as weak as they are there. In the Goldwater year, we did manage to elect some Republican congressmen, but that's only because Wallace just didn't take any part in it at all. He didn't really give a damn who was elected to Congress.
We elected 5 and 3 remain, is that right?
That's right, yeah. 5 Republicans elected and 3, only two served 2 years. And then when the Republicans made their mistake of running against George Wallace, they just were totally demolished. They are not a significant political force in Alabama, and it's best demonstrated, although he was a weak candidate in many, many respects. Red Blunt's extremely poor race against John Sparkman. Blunt lost his own home county by a huge vote. Of course, he had both newspapers against him in his own county. Blunt did. Blunt had it. We supported Sparkman. They just cannot be regarded.
Was the post office a big issue in that race?
A minor one. There was a lot of jokes about Blunt screwing up the mail service and that sort of thing. But it was not a significant issue at all. It was the big issue as far as Blunt was concerned was trying to tie John Sparkman to McGovern, the McGovern crowd type thing. You know, he's part and party of the same system and what have you. And that's just a little bit too much bullshit for even the most unsophisticated Alabama voter to swallow. It was an insult to them in a way.
So the post office thing was sort of, it was significant insofar as drawing the issue of Blunt being inept.
Yeah, it was to the most minor degree. It was more of a joke than anything else.
But it was successful as a joke because here he's trying this bullshit on politics and so people could laugh at him at the post office. Even if you didn't blame it on him, it came across as him being inept. Is that
very much
correct?
Very much it is. And now, I think it would be very difficult to prove this, but even Blunt's own people tend to say that that this hurt him. This particular strategy that he tried to make, that he was just an average Alabamian, and he showed pictures of himself in his shirt sleeves and no tie on, standing by the fence out in the country. A totally opposite picture of what Red Blunt was. He was a multimillionaire, living in a $750,000 house with what Wallace said was 26 bathrooms in it. Actually, it was only 8 bathrooms, but that was enough. But his people kept saying, you know, forget this business and say, I'm a self-made man and I'm proud of it. And I'm not ashamed of the fact that I've made some money in my life in a very honorable way, and we're going to conduct this campaign on the basis of the issues and not on the basis of how much money I've made. Now, that's what they wanted, and he never did that. He tried to go the opposite route and try to look like a common man and this kind of thing. And I really believe that was the principal issue, coupled with his, well, he was so arrogant. He would put up billboards. Red Blunt stands for getting the welfare freeloaders off their asses, and things are not off their asses, but that sort of thing. He'd use welfare freeloaders, and that kind of thing. And he really just came very close to insulting the intelligence of the voters by suggesting that a man that they had in the United States Senate since 1946 and had voted in many, many times with overwhelming majorities, was guilty of all these sins, that he was a part of the McGovern crowd and that sort of thing. So he was just, as I say, was obliterated in the thing. Even the polls were wrong on how one-sided. It was about a 2-1 victory for Sparkman. And I frankly think, now they're going to pick up a few seats in the legislature as a result of reapportionment. That's not going to be terribly significant.
Well, they have two, don't they?
I believe that we now have two blacks and two Republicans in the legislature. And they're both of them are going to pick up a good bit in the next session. So they're just not really a force at all and don't stand to be one for a good long while. They just don't understand politics, for one thing.
Is it a question just that they lack leadership? Lack effective leadership, rather.
Very much lack effective leadership and are given to these profoundly boring ideological disputes and petty disputes at that. Republican politics is characterized by petty personal hatreds of one another. Even these override ideological differences, and there are damn few ideological differences. It's basically Goldwater Republican philosophy. It's sort of a let them eat cake philosophy, you know.
Not any moderates in the party of any
stature? Very few, and what moderates were in it have been just about demolished. John Grenier represented the moderate element, a damn good man, and even he was a Goldwater man.
Yeah.
But he represented the moderate element as well as anyone did. And just a few days ago, I was talking to a woman who's been very active in Republican politics, and she said she just got so damn fed up and sick of trying to fend off and keep that John Birch Society crowd under control that she got out of Republican politics. And she's out now. She's an independent. And she says that she's very likely to support, Democrats the next go-around and so on. You might want to talk to her.
What's her name?
She's kind of windy. Her name is Virginia Garrett. She's from Montgomery, and she has been on the state Republican Executive Committee and was a pretty potent force as they go in Republican politics.
What happened to Grenier?
I'm not real clear on the details of it because a lot of it was this personal petty stuff. But Grenier is not a presentable candidate. He ran for the U.S. Senate at the same time that Martin was running for governor against Lurline Wallace. That was in 1956. And some bad 66. Personal... 66, I'm sorry. And some bad personal things went on. It's been pretty clearly demonstrated that Martin tried to shaft Grenier. And this is something really that would need to be checked out. But my impression is that at one point, Martin, seeing the disaster that was looming for him, actually tried to get Grenier to switch over to run for governor and let him run for Senate, that kind of thing. You know, in mid-campaign he wanted to. That's the kind of crazy stuff they do, these Republicans. But anyway, Grenier has been pretty well pushed out altogether. I think he'd talk to you.
He's still in Mobile?
He's still in Birmingham. He's a Birmingham lawyer and a smart guy. He's a very bright guy.
I remember talking to him back in 64.
He's mostly a machine-type politician, a manipulator of conventions and things like that. That's where he does his best work.
Did they ever do any effective precinct-level organization in Alabama, even in 64?
No, absolutely none. Absolutely none.
Okay.
From the inside.
I'll forward it to Virginia Garrett.
She's a real likable.
Is she a married woman?
Yeah.
What's her husband's name?
Her husband is Wilmer, W-I-L-M-E-R, Wilmer Garrett. But she's a real tiny little thing and just as vivacious as she can be, about 42 or 3 years old. And her husband just hates politics and is trying his best to get her out of it. She won't do it. She's thinking about running for the city commission and probably would run for the Republican if she did. But she might run as an independent. I don't know.
Republicans doing anything on the municipal level in the major cities?
Well, of course, now they've elected a Republican mayor in Birmingham. But that could be the importance of that could very easily be overstressed because it was sort of a nonpartisan election that he was elected in. And besides that, Birmingham's got a very heavy Republican sentiment up there. That's where it is.
Was the Republican Party in Alabama doing anything before the Goldwater movement?
To my best knowledge, it was nothing in the world but a facade of patronage. It was operated pretty much that way, as a closed shop, as long as Claude Vardaman had it. He was the keeper of that facade for a good long while. And it was a closed club. They didn't even pretend to engage in political activity, in election activity, that is. And it was out of this group. They mostly drew themselves from old-line Republicans, anti-secessionist Republicans and that type. And a post office, federal judge operation is what it was. It was out of that group that we got several of our very good federal judges, including Frank Johnson. He came out of that particular Republican element. Well, Vardaman got himself into some trouble. He, having influence in Washington, being the party chairman and so on, even though from a political standpoint it was utterly meaningless in Alabama, got himself in some trouble up there over some housing scandals. He got mixed up in some. I don't think he ever was brought to court, but it was very close. It was a scandal in which some bad was involved. And about this time, too, there was a surge of enthusiasm among Republicans. Eisenhower had done well in Alabama. Nixon had done well in 60 and what have you. They saw that things were changing pretty drastically and that it was indeed time for them to start getting out and politicking like Democrats did to do away with this these country club executive committee meetings that constituted all of the Republican activity in Alabama. And this particular group, who more or less was represented by Grenier and Martin, took away the party from this old crowd, the facade keepers. And they tried to do. They made a conscientious, legitimate effort to organize a genuine political party with activities and election and what have you. It's just that they were so inept at it that it didn't work. Plus Wallace coming along, which made it almost impossible for it to work. They had everything working against them.
How much of a problem was Grenier's national role in that 64 election? If he had stayed on the local and the state and worked at the state level, would it?
Wouldn't have made any difference. No, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. Of course, the state went overwhelmingly for Goldwater.
Right.
In 68, of course, it went overwhelmingly for Wallace.
I'd presume that they went overwhelmingly for Goldwater because Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act. Would that be a fair presumption?
Well, it went further than that. That wasn't the only reason at all. No, it wasn't. He was enormously popular. I'm not sure about this, but I think Alabama may have given him his largest vote. It was almost a religious-like movement. We're going back to... And the Civil Rights Act certainly was the crowning, the icing on the cake. The crowning achievement of Goldwater's great career, and there's not any question that there was an underlying sense that here's the man to stop all that damn nonsense in Washington that they've been inflicting on us and that sort of thing. So race figured into it to a very, very extensive degree, but it wasn't just the Civil Rights Act. That just was kind of epitomized why they were for Goldwater. It would have been. The vote wouldn't have made any difference if he hadn't voted for the Civil Rights Act. Because they weren't going to vote for Lyndon Johnson. He was hated in Alabama. I have to keep in mind, you know, that's during the... He'd come out for civil rights and the poverty program and all
that.
You think if
Goldwater had voted for the Civil Rights Act, it wouldn't have made any difference at all?
I don't think it would have made any difference. It conceivably could have diminished his vote somewhat, but not a great deal.
All right, let me discuss this with you. I can think of a few southern states, possible exception of Texas, that has more of a tradition coming out of the 30s of producing really economic liberal New Deal Democrats than Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Exemplified by Jim Folsom, yeah.
Folsom, Sparkman.
Hill, Sparkman, yeah. All of Bob Jones, Carl Elliott, all of them, yeah.
Claude Pepple came out of Alabama.
Well, except he, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he got elected from Florida, but he grew up there.
Mm-hmm. Bib Graves, yeah. Hugo Black.
Hugo Black. Yeah. So is that, where is that background of economic populism? What's the status of it today, politically?
The status of it is it's been very sharply modified. Wallace is if you're using the old definitions of populism, Wallace could be called justifiably a pseudo populist. He wasn't like Gene Talmadge, one of these fake populists who gets up and mouths all these things about what he's going to do for the people, and then makes his covert deals with the economic powers of the state. Gene was the most vivid example of the faker. The man who spoke for the people but represented everything against their interests.
Probably.
There was a little ditty, you might want to dredge it up and put in your book. It goes, the hookworms courted the big bugs, and their clandestine embrace produced a governor of Georgia who raised hell all over the place. And that was pretty much what Talmadge was. He was the epitome of the fake populist. Well, Wallace wasn't this at all. He came out of the Folsom tradition, and his rhetoric was extremely populist, no doubt about it, whatever. And to a large extent, he tried to carry it out. A good example of it is that junior college and trade school program which he built. He, without adequate financing and things like that, he rammed this through the legislature. And his idea was to create a junior college program where every kid could go with no money if he didn't have it, and if he couldn't get there, they'd send a school bus to pick him up and get him there. Well, in concept, it was very good, but like so much of Wallace's stuff in concept, it didn't take the practical considerations of how you're going to pay for this thing, where you're going to get faculties to put this sort of thing up. What it amounted to was they raided the high schools for their faculties and just added 2 years to the high school is what it amounted to, which wasn't too bad. And also there was a lot of political wheeling and dealing about where they'd be located, and some of them were located in very bad places. But nonetheless, the idea was still there, and it was a good idea, and it represents Wallace's populism. He did a lot for the people. He's done a lot for education, for instance, in the way of funding and things like that. But then when you get on the other side of the populist issue, this is where you have a sharp departure from Jim Folsom. Folsom's idea was to hitch up the big mules, you know, what that was his term. We're going to hitch up the big mules. That may have been Bibb Graves that used that term rather than Folsom, but they were both meaning that we're going to put it on the damn corporations for a while, like Huey Long did in Louisiana. But Wallace didn't do this. His taxing programs went straight to the consumer. One of the very first things he did was to impose an additional sales tax. He increased the beer tax. He increased the cigarette tax. Increased the beer tax twice, if I'm not mistaken. Increased liquor taxes. Increased the price of, double the price of driver's licenses. He increased the price of tags from, now he'd say he didn't do this, the legislature did it. But the only reason the legislature did it is because he financed he put through a bond issue and he said he didn't give a damn where it was paid for. And the legislature was forced to enact this increase in the price of automobile tags from $3.75 to $13.75, an extra $10. All right, then on the other side of the ledger, what did he do for the corporations? They had a very low income tax, as it was, and he increased that by the most modest amount from, I think, a maximum of 3% to a maximum of 5%. And in return for that, he wrote the 5% ceiling into the state constitution, which makes it very difficult to change now. It was statutory up to that point. And so in reviewing Wallace's tax record, you find that that virtually all of his taxes were put on the consumers. Almost none were put on the corporations and industries.
How about income tax?
There was no increase in income tax except for this slight corporation income
tax. No increase in personal income?
No, none on personal, no.
What's the maximum rate now?
I believe it's 5%, but I'm not absolutely sure. I think it's 5% for individuals. It's relatively low. We have no property tax in Alabama. It's almost non-existent. So that study by Ivo Gambolis, have you seen it yet, from Southern Regional Council? Well, you'll find that most revealing. You ought to get a copy of it. It's just out. It shows that among all of the southern states, Alabama has one of the most regressive programs. All of the southern states have regressive tax programs, but Alabama's is one of the worst. And now I don't have the up-to-date figures on this, but I think this is a very meaningful figure to me, because Wallace is always going around talking about tax reform. But when you adjust state and local taxes in Alabama for income levels, you're going to find that Alabamians are paying roughly $66 per $1,000 income in state and local taxes, as opposed to $55 per $1,000 income in the nation. So that's a pretty substantially heavier tax load in Alabama than the nation has. And he can't refute that. I mean, that's just, you know, statistical information. So then you see he is, as I say, he is a pseudo-populist. He's done all these things, but he's gotten it out of the people, not out of the corporations, like the old populist wanted to do.
Well, doesn't he make a little rhetoric against the corporations?
Damn little. And he does it against the foundations. That's one of his big... You never hear any Wall Street type rhetoric from Wallace, not like you did back in the old days. What situation
is that? I thought occasionally he got on the utilities.
Yeah, he jumps on them occasionally, but when he does, as a rule, it's not an attack on the utilities. It's an attack on the press. He says that we're going to stop these utilities from advertising in the press because it's a form of bribery. They don't have to advertise. They are monopolies. The only reason they advertise is so they can get the newspapers to support their rate increases when they go to the Public Service Commission. That's the way he jumps on the utilities. It's really more an oblique attack on the newspapers than it is on the utilities. He doesn't attack them, no. He did, I will say, come down on the side of REA the other day in a dispute with the power company, but it was of little consequence. It didn't amount to anything.
How does he work, react, relate with organized labor?
Well, I was talking to this guy, what's his name, the labor man?
Wilbur Hobby,
the other night. I made the remark that labor has made its peace with Wallace in Alabama. And he very quickly corrected me, and he said, Wallace has made his peace with labor in Alabama. He put it the other way around. And he says the reason that this was is because labor really did a job on Wallace in 68, and that's true. The labor had a profound effect. I shouldn't be surprised if labor didn't. Well, you might recall that going into the 68 race, that Wallace was holding steady in all of the public opinion polls at right about 20% of the vote. Well, when it came out, he didn't get but 13% of the vote. And I'm convinced that that gap of 7% was that mammoth effort that labor put forward, exposing Wallace as a phony populist and talking about these same taxing programs, and mainly talking about his position on things like unemployment compensation, workman compensation, and things, and minimum wage, and things like that.
And what has his attitude been on those issues?
Well, according to labor, now these are complex issues that I don't understand well, but labor was very dissatisfied with his attitude on it. And they campaigned heavily against him because of that. But I know that Barney Weeks told me, now he's the head labor man. So Barney is the head labor man in Alabama.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. And he told me just a few weeks ago, he says, we're not picking any more fights with Wallace. He says, we got our unemployment compensation bills and our workman compensation bills through the last session. He's working well with us now, and we just don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to get into any anti-Wallace fights because we got what we wanted out of it. And as a matter of fact, I think this is fairly significant. When they had the big patriotic rally at Decatur, when Kennedy came down as they put it, to make Wallace an honorary nigger.
Is that how it's viewed in Alabama? Is that how it's viewed in Alabama?
Yeah, that thing backfired like hell on Wallace too, by the way, but that's another subject. But in any case, I watched this, and Barney Weeks was sitting over, he's the labor man, was sitting over in one of the side stands for all these ceremonies up there. 4 years ago, Barney Weeks wouldn't have been caught dead at a thing like that, but he was over there anyway. And I saw someone come up to Barney and whisper something in his ear. And Barney got up and went back and sat down on the main stage with Wallace. There was about 40 or 50 people on the main stage. Kennedy and Wallace and all of Wallace loyalists and what have you. When they started to introduce the guests, the master of ceremonies introduced all sorts of guests who were there, but he didn't mention Barney Weeks. And when Wallace got up to make his little speech, he mentioned Barney Weeks. He said he was glad to have Barney Weeks on the stage with him, so he's made his peace with labor, there's no doubt about it. So whoever made whose peace is beside the point, but he's representing labor's interest right now.
What was the effect of that Kennedy visit?
A very, very surprising outpouring of almost hate mail to Wallace. How could you do a thing like this? To such a great extent that Wallace was compelled to get up and make almost public apologies. It wasn't quite apologies, but almost ridicule the meeting. As soon as that thing was over, he started saying, now look here, I didn't invite them to come down here. They were the ones that said they wanted to come down and honor me. I didn't go see them. They came to see me. And if you'll notice, I was on the right up there. and that kind of thing. He made it appear that what they're doing is coming to Alabama to pay homage to him, that he wasn't the one that changed, they're the ones that changed. But the net effect of it was a political minus for Wallace, one that he hadn't counted on and wouldn't have done if he'd known about it. When he says he wasn't a party to the arrangements, of course, that's silly. You know, damn well he was. It was worked out between Wallace and Kennedy people.
But nationally, he got some plus out of it.
Nationally, he got a lot of minus out of it, too. He got letters from all over the country against it. They let us read Wallace's mail up there. I don't know that Wallace knows this, but we've got good contacts in the office that will just let us read the mail. And these old Wallace faithful, the people that used to send nickels and dimes and scribble notes on tablet paper, they didn't send no nickels and dimes for those scribble notes. They raised hell about it. They didn't like it a bit. It's no major thing, but it did create a reaction against him. And I'm convinced that if he had known what was going to happen, he wouldn't have shown up in Decatur. Wouldn't have gone.
It was that much?
Yeah, it was enough that he wouldn't have done it, yeah.
I was thinking, is it not a plus for him with from the other side that the Wallace haters
gives him respectability?
Yeah.
Well, that's what the whole purpose of the thing was.
So wasn't it basically a success insofar as that was concerned?
To a large extent, it was. Yeah, it was that to a large extent. And I think the national press covered it in that way, that after all these years of being a pariah and an outcast and what have you, they welcome Wallace back into the family. And we need him, that sort of thing. See, they had big wigs of the Democratic Party down there. They had Strauss and that sort of thing. Strauss is just almost obsequious in his service to Wallace. He sounds like a Wallace supporter at times. And I'm not so sure he's not. I know this positively, because I know a man that won't lie, who heard the telephone call when they were, after Strauss took over the Democratic Party, and he called up Wallace and says, "Governor, we want you represented in the Democratic Party, and we've got vacancies to fill here, and we've got one specific vacancy, and we want you to name the man who's going to get it." And Wallace says, "I want Mickey Griffin to have it," and Mickey Griffin got it.
So who's Mickey Griffin?
He's Wallace's man on the National Democratic Committee. He's his personal choice as a member of the committee. In addition to that, Strauss also, now I can't prove this quite so easily as I can prove that other. I know that other is true. But I'm under the very distinct impression that Strauss went to great lengths to gut to Bob Vance, the state Democratic chairman who's been Wallace's most persistent enemy in Alabama over the past, for all of Wallace's political career. He's been the thorn in his side, embarrassing him by having his own political party against him, his own Democratic Party against him. And Strauss made every effort to gut Vance. I believe that Vance holds the position of chairman, of the Democratic chairman, you know, chairman of the whole nationwide organization. And Strauss tried to keep him from getting that as a favor to Wallace, but he wasn't able to do it because Vance has got a lot of strength in his own right.
What has Vance done with the party, and what has happened to Cashion's party?
Well, Cashion's party was demolished in the last election. It was wiped out as a political force. He showed that he no longer even has the blacks. Cashion was running a candidate for the Senate, and John Sparkman, running as the regular Democrat, probably outpolled in the black community alone, probably outpolled Cashion's candidate by about 6-1. So he was destroyed in that election. I haven't even heard of John Cashion since that election. And it would surprise me very much if he even surfaces this year.
So Vance has put together the coalition.
He's put together the coalition, but the most effective thing that Vance has done has been to hold the state Democratic Party together as an anti-Wallace organization. Now, he was able to do this for the reason that I mentioned, is because the Democratic Party is largely an impotent institution. It doesn't have any effect. Political power in Alabama is held by individuals, not by party structures and things like that. The one thing that Vance does have, and proof of this, is the fact that Wallace has never made any real effort to take over the party. He could have done so. If he'd given it a moment's thought and a moment's effort, he could have taken that party from Vance at almost any time he wanted to. But he didn't do it. He now sees that perhaps he is going to have to do that, because the sole power that Vance has got is to embarrass him by having the Alabama Democratic Party against George Wallace. He is a man who's pretending to be a National Democrat and a candidate for president. He doesn't even have his own state party behind him. And my guess is that he's going to take it this year. He's going to take control of the party.
You don't see the two of them making peace?
So. I don't. I absolutely don't. I'll show you a letter that I wrote in advance. It's a joke, but anyway, which pretty much outlines it. I think Wallace is going to do him in. They just held a meeting at which Vance announced that this is the most productive and harmonious meeting we've ever had, supposedly meaning that all the blacks, all the loyalists, all the women, all the Wallace folks, and everybody else came together, and now we've got one great big happy party. Well, all in the world they did at that meeting, it was a midterm meeting, was get ready for an election, at which Vance and Wallace are going to have a showdown over control of the party. That's what happened. And with Wallace's sword at his throat in what they call the bitches of Birmingham at his rear, he's probably going to lose it. I wouldn't be surprised if he did.
What's the bitches of Birmingham? Really?
The Women's Liberation. Oh. They think that Vance is a male chauvinist. Drives Vance crazy. He's been trying to do the right thing all these years, and he's got these women against him.
So they're gonna get together with George Wallace?
Well, they know they're the most anti-Wallace people in the state, but they're big on principle. They fit well in the Republican Party. Virginia Dare is, I think, the most knowledgeable person in Alabama on politics, although also the least practical person. Do you know who Virginia is? She's kind of the elder stateswoman of liberal politics. Clifford Dare.
Yeah.
Well, Virginia's very active in politics, and she was looked upon in the women's liberation movement almost as the patron saint of liberated women and things like that. So she went up to Birmingham and just threw the place into an uproar by promptly throwing in her lot with Vance. She told these women, says, look, you're asking for them to give you all these things? You can't give political power. That's like trying to turn lead into gold. Political power comes from one thing, from getting out and asking the people for it and getting elected. What I'm telling you to do is to get out there and fight like men. That was beautiful. And Virginia just left them in complete disarray. They didn't know what to do after she did that. Fight like men.
Well, Wallace though would not be shrewd enough to see how leaving Vance as chairman could accrue to his benefit.
No, he wouldn't. It would not accrue to his benefit at all, because he cannot trust Vance. And the enmity between those two men is too great for him to take any chances like that. And since he has now sort of irrevocably cast his, I say irrevocably, I'm not real sure about that. I can conceive of Wallace running as a third-party candidate again in 76. But since at the moment he is irrevocably committed to the National Democratic Party, it's much in his interest to regain control of the committee. So there won't be any doubt about it when the time comes that the state party is going to be embarrassing him in the nation. That's the only power it's got.
What would be the significance of the chairman's demise?
Well, they'd install a Wallace chairman. Presumably Mickey Griffin would get it. He's carrying Wallace's, all of his Democratic Party affairs. He's his chief of staff for the party.
But would that affect the coalition that Vance has put together?
It would certainly weaken it drastically, yeah. It would turn it into, it would be a, in the eyes of the blacks and in the eyes of the women and the liberals and the loyalists and what have you, would be a gross act of bad faith, of breaching the, this illusion of harmony that we've achieved. And it would have the effect of destroying whatever has been achieved.
It was in that context that I was thinking, could Wallace perceive it to be his advantage to leave Vance alone?
That conceivably could happen, but it would surprise me very much if that happens. It really would. If I were Wallace, I wouldn't take a chance. I'd put my own man in there. Because he doesn't need that kind of unity. He doesn't need it.
But wouldn't it be useful to him, say, going to a national convention?
It would be useful there, yeah. But I just don't think you're ever going to get Bob Vance to go to a national convention and support George Wallace. The 72 convention, the political sentiment in favor of Wallace for president at that time in that state among Democrats was probably running 80% or better. And Bob Vance went down there and was in a very small minority who cast his vote against Wallace. He voted for Terry Sanford for the nomination on the first ballot. Now, Wallace can't tolerate that kind of thing, or even a chance of that happening with a man like that running the party. It's just, you know, the enmity is too deep for him to be taking chances on leaving Vance in. I think if he could make, you know, get some sort of positive commitments out of Vance, that he'd be a Wallace man. But for God's sakes, Vance has, you know, got too much self-respect for that sort of thing, plus the fact that he's campaigning for a federal judgeship, I think. Now, that's the utmost speculation on my part. I've never heard Bob Vance say one word about that. It just stands to reason that he sees that as his, you know, what he's earned for his participation in politics and about the only thing within his grasp, because he doesn't have any political office that he can reach for. So he's not going to switch to be a Wallace man. That's what he'd have to do, and it would be like asking me to switch to be a Wallace man. He and I, you know, our politics is very much alike, and I don't think he's likely to switch any more than I am. Only time Van